This episode is brought to you by Infosys Public Services, a leader in next-generation digital solutions and consulting for the DMV. Learn more at infosyspublicservices.com/DMV. Welcome to AnvaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Anva community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the AnvaCast. This week, I am welcoming one of Anva's key strategic partners, Tim Adams, the executive director of the International Registration Plan, more commonly referred to as IRP. Tim, welcome to your very first appearance on the AnvaCast.
Well, thank you, Ian. I'm very happy to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
IRP. Let's talk about what IRP, the International Registration Plan, is. We'll give our listeners who may not be as familiar with that side of the business a little bit of background. Give us the high level kind of 101. If you're at a cocktail party and you introduce yourself and what do you do during the day, Tim? Well, I'm the chief executive of IRP, and they go, okay, what does that mean?
Sure. Right. Okay. Well, yeah, IRP is basically it's a compact between the states of the U.S., continental U.S., and provinces of Canada for the registration of commercial motor vehicles to operate interstate, or we say interjurisdictional because of the Canadian provinces, of course. And basically what the IRP does, it is a registration agreement that helps to facilitate the registration process of commercial vehicles involved in interstate operations and the collection of the registration fees and sharing of those registration fees based upon the operations of the motor carriers. And so each state is getting their fair share based on the operations of the vehicles operating on their highways. And so that's in a nutshell what the agreement is. It's we have 48 continental U.S. states are members of the agreement, as well as Washington, D.C., and 10 Canadian provinces. So we have 59 members altogether, jurisdictional members. And of course, we also work very closely with our industry partners, as industry was a key part of building the agreement years ago. So.
When was that, when you say years ago? When does the agreement go back to?
Well, it actually goes back into the 70s. Actually, okay. If I would date it back to where it really began, was in 1968. Around that time, it probably started being talked about prior to that. But there was a committee in AMVA at that time, mm-hmm. that was developed to come up with a better registration agreement than the old reciprocity agreements, which granted free reciprocity. IRP was put together, and there were 9 signatory states in the mid-70s that signed on. Kentucky was one of those. I worked for Kentucky for a long time, and they were one of the first states, and Alberta was the first Canadian province to join, hence we changed it and called it. It was initially going to be called the National Registration Agreement, and with adding our Canadian members, we changed it to the International Registration Plan. That was before any trucks were ever registered under the agreement. But it started back in, I think the first IRP registrations were issued in 75, in 1975, and then it's just kind of evolved from there with the last jurisdictions joining in the early 2000s. So
now, and why? I mean, what existed before that doesn't exist now? What problem was it solving, starting in the 70s and still solving today, that if the IRP didn't exist, what would be the situation?
Well, the big issue was, I mentioned the reciprocity agreements. Basically, there were reciprocity agreements that existed within regions of the U.S. or Canada and with between bordering states that covered certain bits of interstate commerce. As trucks began to move all across the nation, not just regionally, there were operations outside of their own jurisdiction becoming more prevalent. There was a need to share that revenue, because free reciprocity has a real nice ring to it, but it doesn't pay for the infrastructure. And so basically the whole idea was, if a truck was operating at 80,000 pounds on a jurisdiction's highways, they would do some money for that, because the damage,
the wear and tear on the roads and bridges.
Exactly. Sure. Exactly. And it was just at that time, a lot of back in the 60s and the 70s and even up into the 80s, there were requirements of carrying dual registration plates on vehicles. So you would see trucks with as many as 7-8 license plates on it, so they could operate. And I recall Kentucky and Ohio, we had some pretty good reciprocity, but nothing that covered like intrastate movements. So a lot of trucks, a lot of carriers had to dual register their vehicles. And so IRP took care of that, because a registrant, if they're operating, say, 50% of their operations in Kentucky and 50% in Ohio, I use my own base state as an example here, but they would pay 50% of the registration fee for Kentucky and 50% for Ohio. It'd all be paid to their base jurisdiction and then distributed to the other states accordingly. But it basically is spreading the wealth of the registration fees where it belonged. And so,
and as a practical matter, instead of having to register in all the states that you're driving in and putting those plates on the back of the truck, you do it all in one place. You have one plate, and it authorizes you to go everywhere else.
Absolutely. That's one of the key provisions of IRP is one plate, one cab card. And so therefore, it that takes care of the registration for all jurisdictions. So.
But you did mention at the earlier, you said there were two states that are not currently members of IRP.
Yeah, yeah. Alaska and Hawaii are not.
Oh, okay. So all the continental,
All the continental U.S. are. Yeah, so, and as a matter of fact, Alaska was a member at one time, but they found it not economically feasible for them to participate because there just wasn't the revenue to cover the expense of being a member, and there wasn't enough of their industry interested. So.
And I suppose just not enough volume of interstate traffic, or case, you know, cross-border traffic, because really trucks would be coming from Canada.
Exactly. Exactly.
So talk to us about sharing that revenue and how that works as a practical matter. If one state is collecting it from the motor carrier or the driver, how do they get that out to everybody that needs a little bit of that money?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what happens is that each state each month is required to report on any registrants that they have registered to operate in all the variant jurisdictions. They do that on a monthly basis. And so the fees then are shared as well each month. And so at the end of the month, they tabulate everything up, create recap and transmittal reports. This is the old way of doing it, was on paper. Now it's done through our clearinghouse system. But basically, they create the same data, whether they do it on hard copy or in the system, and exchange it between each jurisdiction, and then the fees are then netted, and the recipient states receive their funds. The ones that have to pay additional pay whatever is due. That way, each jurisdiction is getting whatever they are owed on a monthly basis.
And as part of being the administrator of that, you're not only helping them keep track of that, you're actually the one moving the funds for them.
Yes. Well, we are, yes. We don't, for example, a state is going to, if the netted part says a jurisdiction owes $100,000 additional, that'll be spread out amongst many jurisdictions, they would send that $100,000 into the IRP clearinghouse, and then we then distribute the netted funds out to the jurisdictions that are owed the funds. Each month we... It varies a little bit. It probably averages about $100 million a month. Mm-hmm. We have some months that are well in excess of $100 million, and some that fall under that. But just this for last year, 2020, it was $1.1 billion. It's just a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's just constantly moving, almost real time. It's not as if a bunch of money is sitting somewhere and waiting to be counted up. It's just. No. Sophisticated level of wire transactions constantly occurring.
Absolutely. And basically, we do it once a month. And so the jurisdictions, as they're collecting the monies, they then send it in to the clearinghouse after it's netted. They send in whatever their summary is that they need to send. And then we distribute that within 5 days of receiving it. So
largely automated, I would assume.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's all automated. We, as a matter of fact, on the clearinghouse accounts, we have it set up where there can be no checks in or out of it. It's all electronic. So.
And how does a motor carrier determine that proportion of what's going where. Is it happening? Are they reconciling real time where the trucks have driven, or are they on their honor saying this is how we expect to spread it out?
Yeah, it's basically there's a reporting period each year that they're reporting their annual activity in each jurisdiction. Now, the motor carriers are required to keep daily logs. A lot of that is electronic now through GPS reporting, through various other levels, but they are required to maintain records of their operations. So therefore, they're reporting their actual distance. And they are subject to audit. Now, it's not a guarantee that they're going to be audited, but it's a carrier is subject to audit. Each jurisdiction is required under the IRP to audit 3% of their carriers each year. So there's a good number get audited, but it is somewhat of an honor system because, you know, you're accepting that they're signing their application, that it's what they're presenting is true and accurate. So, you know.
And I imagine over the years, though, the jurisdictions know enough about the demographics of their motor carriers to know when something doesn't pass the smell test.
Yes, yes. And actually, given, you know, technology where we're at today, a lot of edits have been built into computer systems to detect things that just don't look right, you know.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, no matter how much technology you have or how many edits you put in, there always can be something that gets passed. But that's what the audit program's for. And jurisdictions, they do analyze their applications and such to ensure that they're getting what looks to be accurate anyway.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the whole thing started with an AMVA committee.
Yeah.
That it was kind of birthed from AMVA, if you will. And IRP, as I understand it, wasn't always a separate independent organization. Can you share some of that history?
Absolutely. Love to. That's it's a history I know pretty well because I had the opportunity over the years to meet with a lot of people that were instrumental in building the IRP. But basically, IRP started under the Motor Carrier Services Committee within AMVA. That's where we were housed. Before IRP Inc. came to be in 1994 was when IRP Inc. was incorporated. Prior to that, we were part of the Motor Carrier Services Committee. Mm-hmm. And all the repository effort, all that work was all done through that committee. And so basically, the original committee that set up was set up under AMVA by several administrators to explore IRP. And then when it was developed, it was housed under under AMVA. And then in 1994, we incorporated IRP Inc., but we still remained under AMVA. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, at that time, the original board of directors that was set up by for IRP Inc. was made up of folks representing that were appointed by the AMVA chair of the board. And so I think there were like five members that were appointed by the AMVA chair, and there were five members that were elected by the membership. Since then, that's kind of, I believe it was around 2003, we went to a different model that all the board of directors were elected by the membership, which they are still today. And then eventually in 2011, I recall a couple of people along the way. There was many, many people involved that were involved in the process. I know a lot of people that will hear this remember Pat Crahan. Pat Crahan Pat was part of that original group that helped write this. But along the way there, I remember Chuck O'Donnell made a comment one time that, you know, at some point the kid grows up, moves out of the house, and that's the way was sort of the vision that IRP had finally grown up and, you know, move on. But, I think our partnership is just natural because it's a lot of the same. We serve a lot of the same membership.
Right.
And I've relied very heavily on a lot of the people over the years in the AMVA community to help as we move forward to this new IRP thing that we started when we moved out independent. And we still rely heavily upon AMVA today. So, yeah.
It's a really important and special partnership.
Absolutely.
I some of that was only recently reminded yet again and highlighted as I think we all had to pivot this year for the challenges of the pandemic. Talk to us about, yes, you know, how that's impacted IRP members and IRP operations.
Yeah. Of course, one of the things I'll say up front, as far as IRP operations, we were kind of used to the remote work because that's how we function. We don't have brick and mortar, haven't had for some time. And so my staff was very, very well versed in it. But that was by choice. When you have to, it's a little different.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I've seen our membership, and I know speaking to several of our members that have had to refocus and move to remote operations when they shut offices down or when they had to limit staffing in the office and that sort of thing. A lot of state systems weren't set up to handle it. So I know that's been an effort in a lot of states to get their systems where they could function in a remote environment. And then you throw all the other things in there that people are dealing with, and it's just been tough. The waivers and extensions have been another thing, you know, keeping up with what are they doing out there? What are they doing? And, you know, one of our other great partners, CVSA, Colin and his group over there set up that system that allows us to integrate all those waivers and extensions into one place, which has been really a godsend to us. We've always shared those amongst our different organizations between IRP and AMFA and IFTA and all the other organizations, but to have a place that they could all be consolidated has been a really good. But I think one of the things we've kind of struggled with our membership is trying to figure out where can we help? What is it that we can do to make things better for them? And in some cases, there are some things we can do. Sometimes there's just not been a whole lot. But I think keeping the lines open of communication, being able to have, we've held some regional discussions. I know AMFA's mm-hmm. been doing a lot of that sort of thing. Just trying to keep open and feel out where it is that we can help. We've done some virtual meetings. We've done a lot of things trying to engage the membership, and it's been very pleasing to see the number of people we've had participating in some of our virtual events. And
that's
so
great.
Yeah. But one of the things is a walk-in business and the ability for carriers to get done what they need. And I've received a lot of inquiries from carriers saying, hey, I can't do this, can't do it. And sometimes I can help them get to the right person. And we've tried to do as much of that as we can. But at the end of the day, it's very tough on our jurisdictions right now.
Absolutely. And I imagine that the IRP customer, the motor carriers, you know, in some ways this past year, they've been busier than ever. I mean, where everyone is relying even more so than before on truck delivery of everything.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think early on we saw a lot of shuttered doors and things of companies that because the factories were shut down, that sort of thing. But I think there's been a shift to moving the goods and making sure that we have what we need to survive. And so, yeah, everything I'm seeing shows an uptick. As a matter of fact, those dollar figures I talked about earlier for 2020, that's up considerably from 2019. So it just tells you there's a few more trucks out there. We've been hearing too from some of our members and also through our federal partners we've talked some about this with, there's an increase in the number of registrants. And so is that, you know, there's maybe different dynamics that's caused that. Yeah. You know, is it companies that have closed down or let drivers go and people have bought new vehicles or, bought their own vehicle for the first time or something like that. We really don't know, but it seems like the movement of freight is really increased. And so
whether that is folks starting new businesses because of the demand or you're right, or is it reorganization that it's not just the vehicle miles going up, it's the actual entities registering that's going up at the same time.
Absolutely. Because I know talking with FMCSA, there are a lot of new USDOT number registrants. And so with that number increasing too, that just it makes you look at the picture and say, okay, what's going on here? And so far we haven't been able to find the resources or time to analyze that too much.
Right. But, yeah. And does the same process work for the independent operator of a motor carrier? Yeah, and it's not just a motor carrier company, but
right.
if I'm an independent operator, truck driver, exact same process.
Yes, sir. And the IRP does allow that the owner operators, they've been called now, we consider everybody a registrant. But the independents, yes, they can own their own IRP plate on their own vehicle. And of course, in most cases, they're leasing on to a larger motor carrier to broker loads and that sort of thing. So.
And for those that are listening that are less familiar with this line of work, because you mentioned the IRP plate, is that one when you see a plate on the back of a truck or a trailer and it says the word apportioned under it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. The plan requires that the plate on the power unit say either apportioned registration or IRP. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of folks that are listening that may not work in this particular line of our industry that are now going to drive down the road and look at those plates a little bit differently. It's really,
absolutely.
And it's what's interesting about it is you start to realize how much is around you every day that our members, the AMFA members, the IRP members, which as you said, are really one in the same, are touching and doing every day, which is exciting to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned also, Tim, that, you know, you worked for Kentucky prior to being with IRP. Let's talk a little bit about your background. How long have you been executive director of IRP?
Okay. Actually, I've been with IRP. I started this row in, effective full-time June 1st, 2012. So now I guess about 9 years.
But you were already with IRP before you took on the leadership
role.
Yeah.
I left the Commonwealth in 2004 and came to work for AMVA. I actually worked remotely. I think I was one of the guinea pig remote workers for AMVA at the time. And I worked for AMVA for a while. And then in 2009, I was fortunate to move over to IRP. There was some reorganization going on, and I was offered to move over to IRP. And so I worked with there under Mary Pat and some other folks there with IRP for a while. And then as things began to change, I was asked to if I would help out and step in as on an interim basis for as the CEO. And I did that for 6 months and was fortunate to get this job. And so it's been a while. I worked in Kentucky for 24 and a half years I actually started out working in IRP. It's funny. I've been around it now 30 some years, about 39 years. And so it's, but I did, I started out in 1979 working in the Kentucky apportion registration section. We called it. It was an IRP at the time, and worked my way up there and ran our motor carrier division for a while. And actually had the opportunity to job opened up at AMVA, had some interest in it and was fortunate to be hired there. And over the years had a chance to sit on the IRP board and actually chaired that board at one time. And so really had been blessed to have an opportunity to work with a lot of great folks around the country. I won't start naming names of all the people because I'll surely
forget
to leave
someone out.
That's right. So.
But you've your career has been IRP from start to now. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are you a Kentucky native, Tim?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Born and raised within 2.25 miles of where I live right now. So,
so on that lighter note, because you can't talk about Kentucky without asking, you know, what don't we know about bourbon that we should, or something like that?
Oh,
it seems.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, if you enjoy a good bourbon, the thing to do is enjoy it the way you like it. I know there's a lot of people say, oh, you're going to drink bourbon, you got to drink it straight. No, you drink bourbon the way you like it. And that's all different ways. I like mine with just a little bit of Diet Coke over top of it. And the thing is, it's like with anything, quality really, you get a little more expensive bourbon, doesn't mean it's always going to be better. Mm. You have to find what it is that you like. And it's an interesting it's an interesting thing. I always I've told myself that, and I've told a lot of people this over the years too. I really like a good glass of bourbon, therefore I don't drink a lot of it because I like it.
But if you had your preference, your birthday bourbon, if you will, what would be your
go to? That is Elijah Craig.
Okay,
and I like Elijah Craig, and I'm a small batch blended bourbon drinker. If I characterize myself, a lot of people like small, like the single barrels. I'm more of a blended bourbon person. And Elijah Craig was he was a Baptist minister, was actually named the father or grandfather of bourbon. It's a Heaven Hill bourbon. And it's a really good, smooth bourbon. It's 94 proof. So, you know, you're going to sip it a little bit and there you go. It's
Well, Tim, I think we've just figured out the podcast that you need to start hosting.
Absolutely. Love to. You know, it's interesting. I don't mean to keep on bourbon, but I get a lot of calls from around the country. I think our opportunities at some of our meetings where we shared some bourbons, I think a lot of people send me emails and say, hey, is this a good bourbon? You know, and I say, well, you know, it's all in your own taste, but yeah, it's good.
Well, I'll be honest, I haven't found the one I like yet, so I will look forward to our next meeting where maybe you can coach
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. Absolutely, my friend. Always happy to. Always happy to.
Well, Tim, thanks for joining us for a little bit today to talk about IRP, give some background, and to hear how you're all working through the unusual year that was 2020 and continues at least into the first part of 2021.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. We kind of stuttered a little bit when the pandemic first started about whether to move forward, but we've got some exciting projects happening with redeveloping our clearinghouse system into what we're going to call the new IRP data repository. And we're implementing a new LMS system. So a lot of things going on just like you guys have, I know, and it's exciting times for us.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thanks again. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Thanks to our producer, Claire Jeffrey. And we'll see you next week on the AmvaCast. Stay well, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for AmvaCast, hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Infosys Public Services. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.